I'm Jeff Bossert, filling in for Celeste Quinn on the Afternoon Magazine. Yesterday, baseball's National Baseball Hall of Fame inducted quite a few names. The one Major League player, Bruce Sutter, the one former Major League player, but also 17 players as well as executives from baseball's Negro Leagues. And we're going to talk a bit about that induction ceremony today. We're going to have two guests. Joining us by phone is Dr. Lawrence Hogan. He's a senior professor of history at Union County College of New Jersey. He's an expert on the history of black baseball and has sponsored a tourist exhibit on the subject that has traveled nationwide earlier this year. Mr. Hogan sat out on a committee of historians responsible for choosing from 94 Negro League players and executives for Hall of Fame induction. The panel will let list down to 17 that I just mentioned yesterday. Those names posthumously were inducted yesterday. Dr. Hogan is also the author of the book Shades of Glory, The Negro Leagues and the Story of African-American Baseball. Joining me in the studio is Ernie Westfield. He pitched seven seasons for the Birmingham Black Barons in the early 60s, a time when many talented players that spent a brief time in the Negro Leagues, like Ernie Banks, Willie Mays, and Hank Aaron, had already joined the integrated major leagues. Westfield makes his home in Urbana, and he participates locally in a lot of vocational baseball-related activities. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Nice to be with you.
Nice to have you. Dr. Hogan, do you prefer Larry Lawrence? What would you prefer to be, or just Dr. Hogan?
I prefer anything you want to call me.
All right. Okay.
No, that's fine. Larry is fine. Dr. Hogan is fine. Whatever you're comfortable with.
Well, were you able to attend yesterday's induction ceremony?
Yes, I was. I was in Cooperstown starting on Friday, actually, for the events that began with the dedication of a wonderful statue to Satchel Paige, and then continued through Saturday and into Sunday with the induction.
Well, tell me your impressions of it. I watched it online. ESPN Classic had showed the majority of it. They had to break for commercials during some of those names that were inducted. But you were partially responsible for that list of names. Did it serve justice to some of these names that are not well known to people other than historians such as yourself?
Well, I think it was a day of much justice, of much catching up, coming much too late. It would have been, you know, so much better. As Faye Vincent said when we came out of our meeting in Tampa after the vote, something wonderful has happened, but this is something that should have happened 20 years ago or 25 years ago. It just took a long period to bring education forward about the wonderful history of the Negro Leagues, and the Hall doing a marvelous job, I think, in the effort to reclaim a piece of baseball's history that had been lost. Does it do complete justice to? I don't think by any means. I think there are still players and executives that call for further consideration, and I hope the Hall will find a way to put a frame in place that will allow us to do that.
Let's talk a bit about your writing about this. How did you first got involved? I mean, your book, Shades of Glory, covers so much ground. It talks about so many different teams in black baseball, so many different separate leagues. I mean, there were up to, I think, 20 different leagues of African-American baseball.
Well, the book, of course, I was the principal author, and it was a wonderful team of authors that worked with me. I edited it and wrote several of the chapters myself, but you know, a host of scholars from Jim Overmeyer to Neil Lacktot to Leslie Heapy and a host of others made major contributions as well. As to how I come to the story, I've been writing and teaching and reading about black history, African-American history, since the 1960s, the late 60s, when I first came to the subject when I was teaching on the high school level. And I did a book in the 1970s, A Black National News Service, the History of the Associated Negro Press. That was a black version of AP and UPI. And I was writing an institutional history, but I had to get into the great black weeklies, The Defender, The Afro-American, Norfolk Journaling Guide, it's the 30s and 40s and 50s, and even earlier, the golden age of the black press. And I couldn't stay away from the sports pages. I think I got my love of baseball when I was in my mother's womb and kept turning there and finding this rich history. So that's how I kind of entered into it, through the black press and then through the writings of Bob Peterson and John Holloway, two wonderful pioneering authors who first really delved into this subject and then met the ballplayers. And once I began, and I'm delighted that Mr. Westfield is with us today, once I began to meet the players and you know, become friends with them and learn from them so much, I was hooked, and I've been hooked ever since on this topic.
Ernie, did you get to see the ceremony yesterday?
No, I didn't get a chance to see it.
What have you been, you know, have you followed the history of the Negro Leagues more since, you know, in the years past since your playing days and seen how much a rich history there's been?
Yes, I have. Matter of fact, I go into a lot of schools and I do a lot of history things. And because the kids are so interested and they do a lot of research before I get there, I find that I have to do my homework, that I have to know as much about the Negro Leagues as I possibly can. But as I travel throughout the country, you'd be surprised at how many people that come to the malls where I am, and just they're just loaded with history. You hear about the Kansas City Monarchs. I didn't know they had lights when they travel around. And people said, yeah, they came to our town and they had this. So, yes, I do have to study up on that history.
Dr. Hogan, some of the earliest games we look back here in the first part of your book, I mean, involve slaves. I mean, talk about some of these early teams and some of the most successful ones that maybe aren't getting the attention they need until you're writing such as yourself.
Yeah, I think some of the best parts of our work, the research and writing we did, is that pre-1900 period, which had been largely overlooked. And to be able to take this story, there's a wonderful phrase that I use in my teaching. It actually comes from a book that Secretary of State Dean Acheson wrote about Harry Truman. The title of it was Present at the Creation. Well, we take the story back into slavery times. The sources allow us to do that. The WPA, the Works Progress Administration, in the 1930s sponsored a very extensive series of interviews with ex-slaves who were then up in their 60s and 70s and 80s. And interspersed through this body of interviews, we've discovered, and we by no means exhausted the entire body of interviews, we've discovered, and part of it is in the book, that indeed baseball, present at the creation, slaves in the 18, we can probably take it back at least to the late 1840s, certainly into the 1850s, and across a wide extent of the American South, on plantations, and you know, in other situations that African Americans would have found themselves in those years, we find baseball being played and being played with zealous and or with zest and relish, and you know, it's really quite exciting.
We're talking about the Negro Leagues this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. Joining us by phone, Dr. Larry Hogan, Senior Professor of History at Union County College of New Jersey, as well as a former Negro League pitcher, Ernie Westfield. If any of you have questions, we welcome your calls, locally 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We welcome your questions. When were the, Dr. Hogan, when were the first teams, I mean, when were the best teams that were first taken seriously? When did they first start getting some notoriety in papers, whether it was, I guess, largely African-American publications? When did we first see, maybe broke through with publications, maybe to some white readers that didn't know of this, these teams?
Well, the coverage in the pre-1900 period is difficult to find, although it's there, and we've unearthed enough to be able to tell that story. The Cuban Giants, the first really professional-based black baseball team, 1885 in Babylon, Long Island, where they play in Trenton, New Jersey in 1886, and it's covered quite extensively in the Trenton white press in that instance. And I've done a lot of work on the Atlantic City Bacharach Giants, one of the founding members of the Eastern Colored League in 1923. And that team comes up to Atlantic City in 1916, and the Atlantic City press is just enamored of these wonderful baseball players who are beating all comers. And you get extensive coverage there of that team. But the heyday for the coverage is really the 20s, 30s, and through the 40s, and that's the heyday of the Negro Leagues, per se. And the black press is where you go. I said the Chicago Defender, the Baltimore Afro-American, Norfolk Journal and Guide, the Cleveland Call and Post, the St. Louis, you know, Call, wherever you where blacks were in significant numbers, particularly in urban settings, there was extensive coverage of these wonderful teams and wonderful players.
Well, let's look through some of these names from yesterday. I had not heard of many. I mean, a lot of people, I think, associate who was on the list, the eligible potential Hall of Famers and was not named. Buck O'Neill is a name a lot of people are familiar with when they bring up the Negro Leagues. He's largely served as an ambassador, I think, to their history in the past 20-plus years, probably more than that. Some of these names from yesterday, watching the ceremony, Ray Brown pitched in the 44 Negro League World Series, won several pennants. Andy Cooper, a left-handed pitcher from the Detroit Stars as well as the Kansas City Monarchs. Willard Jesse Brown, a power-hitting center fielder, led the Kansas City Monarchs to 6 pennants in 10 years. Cristobal Torriente, 17 seasons. He was among the league leaders in doubles in RBI. He led the Chicago American Giants to 3 titles as a center fielder. You had 90-some names initially to choose from, correct?
We did. Yeah, we had 90. And there could have been more than 90. Certainly there are always arguments over, you know, where do you make that cut? And to knock it down to the numbers that we did, 39. Initial committee of 5 met last November in Dodger Town at Vero Beach, and the 5 of us, with Faye Vinson as our chair, narrowed it down to 39, and then we met as an expanded committee in February in Tampa and selected 17 from those 39. And the names you mentioned, I mean, names again that have been lost across the years because, you know, when Satchel Paige was inducted into the Hall, first to go in with Josh in, I think, 71, maybe 72. One of the things he said was, and Mr. Westfield can certainly speak to this too, because he played against some very fine players, even, you know, in the 1950s when the leagues weren't as strong as they were back in the 30s and 20s because the players were now being taken by the major leagues. There were wonderful baseball players, and those names that you mentioned fall amongst them. The Andy Cooper, who my friend Dick Clark, who was on our committee, was a strong advocate for Andy Cooper. And when we looked at his record, my goodness, yes, you know, across the long period of time. And then at the Hall yesterday, and this was the part that touched us the most, all of us who have been involved in this history, we couldn't give this honor, let them smell the roses to these gentlemen who played so well, but their families were there in several instances. The Cooper family, a big turnout, and Andy's son, man, I guess up in his 70s now, read the plaque, and my goodness, I've never heard anything read more effectively in public than that particular reading. So that was particularly touching, and I think particularly gratifying to those of us who have been involved with it. We were able to bring recognition to a lot of the forgotten.
Well, let's throw it to you, Ernie. Talk about some of these opponents. I mean, I knew you played, as I'd mentioned, in the latter days of the Negro Leagues, mm-hmm. but tell me about some of the players you were familiar with before you were signed by the Birmingham Black Barons and the quality of baseball then.
Well, you know, the quality of baseball in the Negro League was great because, you know, I threw the ball very hard. And when I joined the Birmingham Black Barons, I thought I would be able to strike everybody out, and I couldn't. But I found out that I had an infield behind me that just wouldn't wait. One of the players that we had on our team was a guy by the name of Willie Smith that eventually went on to play for the Chicago Cubs. A prolific hitter, a great pitcher, and also Satchel Paige. We all came to Champaign here together, and we came here because of the Eastern Illinois League here that they had here in Champaign-Urbana, which was loaded with college players. So they were able to see the talent that we had because we lost very few games when we came here. And matter of fact, a player by the name of Tom Fletcher, his son is Darren Fletcher. Tom Fletcher was the number one pitcher in the Big Ten for the University of Illinois. And when we came here to Champaign, the University of Illinois allowed him to leave school, just I guess some kind of provisional thing, to pitch against Satchel Paige. So the history of a lot of the players in that league is good. I'd like to ask him a question about Double Duty Ratcliffe, if I may. Can you hear me okay?
I can, yes.
Okay. Was Double Duty Ratcliffe considered, I don't know his stats, but there are rumors that he hit over 400 home runs. And was he considered to be a part of going into the Hall of Fame at all?
He was on the list, the original list of 90 that we considered. And he was given very serious consideration. He had a very fine record over a long period of time. His brother, Alex, mm-hmm. in fact, statistically, because there was a statistical compilation that was done by my colleagues, Dick Clark and Larry Lester, that more than ever before, we have a solid record of Negro League play. And we based a lot of our judgments on those statistics. That include barnstorming games. You know, I'm sure Double Duty must have hit 400 or 500 home runs easily across his career, but we were only considering league games. And what was intriguing to us, the both Radcliffe brothers were there, and Alex's statistics came out a little bit better than Double Duty's. And both of them were given very serious consideration. They just didn't make the final cut, but they're both very fine ball players.
Okay. According to the major leagues, league play ended in 1960. Is that correct?
Well, for the purposes of the statistical study, we took it down to 1950.
Okay.
There still are, you played, and, you know, a very fine team. The Negro American League is still in existence through the 1950s. Some seasons more teams than others. The last chapter in our book deals with that. And in fact, even for the first couple years in the 1960s, there's at least some of the old teams playing, whether it's a formal league structure or not at that point in time. But for purposes of Hall of Fame consideration, the cutoff was 1950.
Okay.
Let's talk about, I know better than to ask about how you voted. I know yesterday was an interview conducted with one of your fellow committee members, Leslie Heapy.
Yes.
And she would not divulge anything about, she was asked specifically about Buck O'Neill. But let's talk about, avoid his name being on the list and considered, not considered, and just talk about, as I'd mentioned, his role as an ambassador for the Negro Leagues and what he has brought. He was the first person to the podium yesterday in Cooperstown.
And you can imagine how difficult it was for everyone to follow Buck, because Buck is just wonderful. And not just wonderful in terms of the baseball message and the history message that he delivers, but the values message that he delivers, which is so strong. You had to get 9 votes out of a 12-person committee. That's never easy under any circumstances. Everyone who came away from our committee deliberations, whether they voted for or against Buck, have great respect and great love for the man. And it was so appropriate and so wonderful to see him there yesterday. I remember seeing Buck 3 or 4 years ago in Cooperstown. We were doing an outreach program out of the hall to school children all across the nation. And Buck came in about 1 o'clock on a Sunday night, and I was in the library on Monday morning at the hall, and Buck popped in. I hadn't seen him in 2 or 3 years. I went over and gave him a big hug. We hugged each other. And I looked at him. I said, "Buck, I haven't seen you for several years. You look great." He says, "Larry, good black don't crack." And, you know, he is. He's just wonderful. So it was very, very appropriate that he'd be there last night.
Ernie, have you had a chance to meet with Mr. O'Neill?
Buck O'Neill signed me with the Cubs.
That's correct. I totally
he signed me with
that.
The Cubs, and quite often we meet up again. As a matter of fact, he was at that last All Star game at Comiskey Park. I hadn't seen Buck since he signed me, and he showed up in the dugout.
What is he now? 96, 97?
90, it was 94 or either
95. 94. Yeah, 94 going to be 95.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, they had the Buck Bash. They have one every birthday he has, like they did Double Duty Radcliffe. They have a big thing for them.
And he doesn't appear to be slowing down at all.
No, he doesn't.
Well, let's talk about some of the things he said, too. I mean, Buck, in his address, as you talked about, Larry, really hard to follow up on, but he had said, he's learned never to hate anyone. He's hated illnesses that have taken people, he said I was right on time. I believe that's the name of his autobiography. I was right on time.
Well, you know, I use a quote from Buck in so many of my presentations, because invariably the players will be asked, you know, were you angry, were you bitter, you know, and sure they wanted to play on the highest levels, but they loved what they were doing and they took great pride in what they were doing. And I think Buck answered the question best of all one time. He said, "There's nothing like getting your body to do all that it has to do on a baseball field. It's as good as sex, it's as good as music, it fills you up. Waste no tears on me. I didn't come along too early." And then the phrase that you just mentioned, "I was right on time." So yeah, Buck's got it. He was right on time and remains right on time at the age of 94.
And should mention the first African-American coach in Major League Baseball with the Cubs.
That's right, yep.
We should mention the other name, the other still living member of this initial group to be considered. Minnie Minoso was on that list as well.
That's right. Minnie was, yeah, and a very, very fine ball player who would have been so delightful, given the fact that Buck and Minnie are still with us, to have them smell the roses, but it just didn't happen.
But you alluded to, or well, maybe Buck did more so in yesterday's address, about the, I guess, the heyday of Negro League Baseball in the 30s, 40s, what some of the things that the players had to deal with. Obviously, we've read a lot about, Jackie Robinson, when he broke the barrier, some of the harassment he had to put up with. I wonder if you could talk about some of that that was addressed in the book.
Well, you know, certainly that period of integration and coming into the majors, and frequently Larry Doby is not remembered in the same vein as Jackie, because Jackie came first, but it was only by, you know, a couple of months. Jackie came up in April and Larry comes up in July, and has to face a lot of the difficulties, the same kinds of difficulties that Jackie faced. And that's a story that's been told very, very frequently, very, very well, and needs to be told often, to go back to and to admire what those two gentlemen were able to do with their skills and abilities when they came in. But I would say that, you know, given the subject of yesterday's presentation, that it has to be remembered that they were Negro Leaguers coming in, that they learned their baseball. Jackie only a year, Larry just a couple, but they learned and honed their baseball skills in the Negro Leagues. And that Negro League history, while frequently the story gets to be Jackie, because rightly so, it was so big a story, that's the next chapter, the chapter that is the integration chapter. And the chapter that was there yesterday is that rich heritage of professional baseball going all the way back to the 1880s and coming down to Jackie. James Joe Green, who played for the Kansas City Monarchs, once said, "Jackie didn't pave the way, we paved the way. Jackie was the way," in terms of integration, certainly. So I think that's important, too.
Somebody I had spoken with about, another fellow member of your 12-member selection committee, a professor here on campus, Adrian Burgos, specializes in Latin America. And I had him as a guest. We talked about these other Latino players that had made their mark with the Negro Leagues.
That's very true.
And that's a large part of their history.
From my perspective, the two major pieces that we bring forward that haven't been brought forward in quite this fashion before, that's the pre-1900 story and then the Latin story. And the fact that yesterday that Alejandro Pompez and Jose Mendez and Cristóbal Torriente were given the recognition that they earned and deserved by the quality of their play, and by the case of Alex Pompez, by the quality of the administration that he brought to Negro League Baseball. That was very special. Adrian has done a wonderful job in terms of moving forward that Latin story, and there'd be more to come from Adrian in that regard, too. He's got a biography of Pompez that'll be moving along, and other things that he's working on as well.
Let's talk about how difficult it was for these players to, I guess, maintain careers. I guess it's at some point, I know at one point early in the Negro Leagues, or maybe not the official organized Negro Leagues, some of them had day jobs, and then they were able to work out their schedules where they could play, you know, work at the day job around the baseball season.
Well, perhaps Mr. Westfield would like to speak to that in terms of his own experience.
Talk about that a little bit, Ernie.
Yes, well, playing in Birmingham, I discovered that a lot of the ball players that I was playing with worked in the steel mills down there. And if you look at a lot of the old teams in history, they all worked for steel mills. A lot of them worked for steel mills and a lot of big railroads and stuff like that. And they played baseball. And when you look at that, it's not that much different than back in the old days in the major leagues. Carl Erskine sold cars. He was, you know, and they played the game because they loved the game. And a lot of the places where they worked sponsored those teams. And I look at a lot of pictures that we have on the Negro League calendars, and they're named after the company where they worked. So, yes, they did. You know, they worked on jobs and they played baseball.
Well, welcome your calls for Ernie Westfield, former Negro League pitcher here in the studio, as well as Larry Hogan. Either one of them, you can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We're discussing baseball's Negro Leagues. We'll talk about being signed initially by the Cubs, Ernie, and we talked about Buck O'Neill signing you, and that didn't work out for you, but talk about the discovery of this team in Birmingham.
Okay, what happened? I'd like to go back to Buck O'Neill. I'm from Knoxville, Tennessee, and I was not a pitcher. I was a third baseman, and so one day our pitcher did not show, so the coach asked me to pitch the game, and I pitched a no-hitter. And out of the stand came this black guy dressed in a suit and a brand new car. And being from the South at my age, I had never saw a black man like this before. And he said, I'm with the Cubs and I want to sign you to a contract. And I said, yeah, sure. You know, and I really didn't believe him. But he wanted me to sign a contract before he left town. And my mother worked in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, so she wasn't there. So my aunt had to sign for me. And after he started pulling out all the paperwork and everything, then I started to believe him. So he signed me, and I reported to Mesa, Arizona, along with all the other players. And I played against players like Jesus Salou, Jimmy Ray Hart, Jose Santiago. And a gentleman did an article on me in Evansville, Indiana, and he said I played with over 34 Major League Baseball players. I was with the Cubs for a short period of time, and then after that, after they released me, then I joined up with the Birmingham Black Barons, and I became their number one pitcher, and I lived in Birmingham for that time period. But I was the only player on the team who was not from Birmingham. They discovered me in Knoxville, Tennessee.
And how many seasons with the Black Barons?
I played 7 years. A gentleman by the name of Wardell Jackson bought the Birmingham Black Barons, and that's what brought me to Champaign. And we continued to barnstorm out of Champaign for maybe about 3 or 4 years, and then eventually he switched it over to a team called the Champaign Eagles. And a lot of things happened. The Memphis Red Sox became the New Orleans Eagles or either the Houston Eagles. And I often wondered about why was all these teams named Eagles? They all knew each other. Most of the owners were kingpins, and they knew each other.
You brought up an interesting point. Other guests, maybe you could talk about this, Larry. The business owners became a huge part of the game with the Negro Leagues in the first part of the century. There were a lot of – well, one of the people that we had integrated yesterday – that we had brought into the Hall of Fame yesterday, the first female member of the Hall of Fame, an executive. We can talk a bit about the ownership factor.
Well, the ownership factor is one of a long-standing history, obviously. You know, blacks begin to own teams around the turn of the century, professional teams. A fellow named John Connor in Brooklyn, who was Brooklyn Royal Giants, is a pioneering owner. And, of course, Rube Foster out in Chicago with the Chicago American Giants after 1910. And then a wonderful gentleman in Indianapolis, C.I. Taylor, who was on the list of eligibles and, you know, was given very serious consideration for induction into the Hall of Fame with the Indianapolis ABCs. Mm-hmm. We did induct yesterday, and Mr. Westfield's mention earlier of the lights that he was unaware of that the Kansas City Monarchs had in 1930. We inducted, of course, Mr. Wilkerson yesterday, and his son was there at the age of, I guess, about 80-something to receive the honor that was given to him. And then, of course, Effa Manley as well, the first woman to go in. Come Posey from Pittsburgh, who also was inducted yesterday in the executive category. It was not an easy thing to be an owner. It was a profitable business at many points in time, but not so profitable or profits easy made. It's a record, as was the case with the players, that was largely overlooked. And one of the other interesting features, it seems to me, always of the ownership is that when integration finally came and so many good players were left behind because integration went so slowly, well, there was a body of executive talent and experience that was left behind as well. None of the ownership was transferred over, or any of the people in the front office were transferred over or found an opportunity in what now was integrated organized baseball. So we're pleased that, you know, yesterday we did catch up with some of that history as well.
Anything else about FMLNY you want to add as far as her civil rights efforts? And that's what yesterday, I think she was acknowledged as a trailblazing owner and tireless crusader in the civil rights movement.
Oh, she was. She was a tireless crusader. There's lots of examples of that. You know, in the 1940s, the NAACP was frequently a presence in Rupert Stadium with fundraising drives and membership drives, with EFA playing a very major role in that. The other example that's so frequently cited in the 1930s and mid-30s in Harlem, in New York, when the Jobs Campaign began, a famous Jobs Campaign, we won't buy where they won't let us work, where we're not hired, in the stores in Harlem. And Adam Clayton Powell gets considerable credit for that, but it was really the Reverend John Johnson, a black minister in St. Martin's Church, and FMLNY, who were the key organizing people involved in that that effort. So it was very much a social consciousness on the part of Mrs. Manley that was seen very visibly in so many particulars across those years.
Was this induction ceremony, and which was initially started by your committee, going through this huge list of names, is this seen as a one-time thing, or will we have other Negro League names that come up at possible induction in the future?
Well, I fear that it's the latter, although I take the Hall at the face. They've been wonderful, the Hall of Fame, and the way that they brought this history forward. And they say they will continue to be open to further information and further argument for other deserving candidates. The problem is that there isn't a frame there right now, it seems to me, for that kind of consideration to be really given. The players might find their way into the Veterans Committee. I'm not sure how that's going to work, deliberations, but that would require certainly an education job on the part of knowledgeable people to give them a real fair hearing in the Veterans Committee. So I hope some way this won't be the last, that there will be a possibility to continue to give serious consideration to this history.
A real direct question for Ernie. Can you still throw 80 miles an hour?
I'm not close to 79.
Well, that's
you know,
not bad.
They had the Jerry Mallory historical thing. We had it up near Chicago a couple of years ago. And I was chosen to throw the ball out at the White Sox game. And then they were just amazed. And so I don't know if Mr. Hogan was there. Did you come to the Jerry Mallory thing?
I didn't. Jerry was a very good friend, okay, and a colleague of mine across the years, and a wonderful writer. We've done that. I've been at the one at Harrisburg, and then we did one in Atlantic City where we do our Pop Lloyd programming too. And then they just did another. It's an annual event. I'm so pleased you were able to be there and be, you know, given the attention obviously that you deserve.
Mm-hmm.
And they just did one in Kansas City as well.
Right, right.
You know, this just early in July.
Right. Another question I'd like to ask you regarding Larry Doby. There was an article in the paper. He came into the major leagues 2 months after Jackie Robinson.
Yes.
Virtually unnoticed.
Yeah.
He came in as a shortstop, and he played very sparingly his first year. And the reason for that is that the shortstop for the Cleveland Indians at that time was Lou Boudreau.
Yep.
And what happened is that Al Rosen approached Larry Doby and said, look, if you want to play this game, you need to learn to play another position. So they gave him a film on how to play the outfield. And the next year, Larry Doby started in left field. And according to the article, he said this was the best move because that's where all the blacks sat, in left field. And he said when he would run out to his position, they would tip their hat to him.
Ah.
And he said he felt so very comfortable. But you could still tell that there was some anger because Jackie Robinson took all the limelight. And he said he suffered almost the same or even worse than what Jackie Robinson suffered. And in this article, they had him hugging one of the pitchers of that team that he had hit a home run to help him to win a game. And the pitcher, the white pitcher, received hate mail from all across the country just for that hug.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, that's a very, very famous photo. The name escapes me at the moment, of the photo of the two of them hugging each other. And the other thing, too, that you mentioned there, and it was so true of the Negro Leaguers in general, they were multi-talented athletes. They weren't people who were limited to one position. You talked about beginning at third and then becoming a pitcher. And you know, frequently my friend Leon Day.
Leon Day.
Mm-hmm. You know, was just a if he had played in center field, as he frequently did, or in some of the infield positions that he played, he probably would have had the qualifications for consideration for the Hall. And
mm-hmm.
the Don Newcomb, who was the great hitter as well as a fine pitcher in the Negro Leagues and then
right.
the majors, and that was just common. They played multiple positions.
Mm. I need to ask you a question. What can we do to bring the light of a lot of players that, you know, don't have the name like the Josh Gibsons, the Cool Papa Bell? I think of Oscar Charleston. Oscar Charleston is in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
But he was recruited by, I guess, wasn't Branch Rickey, but he was recruited to scout the Negro League.
Yep.
To try to find the best black ball player, and he came up with Jackie Robinson. And a lot of kids don't know this. You know, how do we bring those players to to light? Leon Day, you hear very little about him.
That's true.
It's a lot of players. Judy Johnson and those players that we have with good batting averages. You know, how do we bring those players to the forefront that our kids can look and say, hey, it was more to the Negro League than just Satchel Paige, Josh Gibson, Cool Papa Bell?
Well, I think, you know, yesterday's event will certainly be an aid in doing that. And the Hall of Fame is putting together an exhibit that will travel around the country.
Oh, okay.
The museum in Kansas City has an exhibit that's traveling as well, and there's a wonderful art exhibit that they've put out. Every year in Atlantic City, the John Henry Pop Lloyd Committee, mm-hmm. Which I serve as secretary and was one of the founders of, holds a weekend celebration in October across 3 days. We do a youth conference at Stockton College where we bring in young people from all around Atlantic City and expose them to the veterans and to the history. We have, you know, 20 or so veterans coming in, and we'd love to have your name on that list, Mr. Westfield. They have my particulars there. If you want to have them send me yours, mm-hmm. I'd be delighted to see if we couldn't include you amongst those veterans. The kind of thing that you're doing, that I hear you say you're doing, is just so important. My friend Stanley Glenn out in
yes.
Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, Stanley says he speaks probably to, I don't know, 50 or 60 or 70 times a year, mm-hmm. perhaps, to young people. So that's tremendously important, too. And in every possible way, the Shades of Glory book that we make reference of,
right.
either the libraries have that or get it into the schools. So,
mm-hmm.
So I applaud you for, you know, the wonderful work you've been doing in that regard.
Thank you. If you don't mind, I'd like to share something with you. This is a poem that I wrote, and I read this at a lot of games around the country. It's entitled Negro League Black Men, and it said they played the game of baseball because they loved the game, but never did they think that it would be harder to get into the Baseball Hall of Fame. They were beautiful black men who played the game with pride. I just wish each of you could have seen Cool Papa Bell when he ran at full stride. He was so fast that daylight couldn't keep up with his speed, and when he was on the base pad, all he needed was a small lead. But then there was Josh Gibson, the best hitter of all time, hit a 500-foot home run out of Yankee Stadium, and the ball they still can't find. But everybody knows about Satchel Paige. He's on everybody's all-star list. Threw a ball so hard that batters just missed. But there were so many Negro League players who never lived their dreams, and that was the one day to play for an American or National League team. So let's honor those black men who played the game so well by keeping their history alive for the younger generation to tell. But let's never forget their struggles and how hard they had to fight, because that was a time when only the ball was white.
You know, that's the best answer, I think, to your question. That poem speaks so eloquently to, you know, the subject of those we have forgotten or don't get remembered as much as some of the big names. And how fast was Cool? Cool was so fast that when he hit a ball through the pitcher's legs, it would hit him in the back as he slid into second base.
Yeah. You know, they said at one time that they put a camera on him because he was going from first to third so fast, they thought maybe he was running across
the diamond.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and Ernie, if you want to talk real briefly too, you've read all these poems to local school
mm-hmm.
kids. You can
mm-hmm.
talk a little bit about some of your vocational activities here
mm-hmm.
in the community.
Right. Well, you know, when I go into a lot of schools, because what happened in the Negro League happened so just a long time ago, a lot of kids that I speak to, they've heard of the Negro League, but they never had the opportunity to see us play. So I start out by telling them that I can understand if you think that the Negro League was a fantasy And that's what my next poem is all about. It's called A Fantasy, and it says, was the Negro League a fantasy, and did it really exist? Or was it something that history just missed? Somebody had to see us play because we were the boys of summer, too. We had our bats, gloves, and uniforms, and we even played under the red, white, and blue. If you didn't see us play, then you missed the hitting of Josh Gibson, the great pitching of Satchel Paige, and the bass stealing of Cool Papa Bell. But if you saw us play, then you know our history, and there's nothing else to tell. Negro League Baseball, where the stars shine.
Wonderful stuff.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You know, on other occasions, whenever I go to schools, there was a young man that came up to me. He said, Mr. Westfield, I heard that they call y'all the Shadow Men, and I had never heard of that before. Have you heard of that term before about the Negro League baseball players?
The Shadow Men?
Shadow Men.
Well, you know, the old Shadow Ball, and our title of our book, of course, Glory in the Shadows, you know, I've never heard the term Shadow Men.
Okay.
Specifically applied to, but I suspect that that's where it comes from.
Okay.
We've got a call here on line one we're going to try to get to. We have to wrap up in a couple of minutes. So go ahead, please. Caller from Champaign.
Yes, I'm calling. You raise an interesting fact. I was driving in concerning the lack of notoriety of Larry Doby compared with Jackie Robinson. I grew up in a southern black neighborhood in Arkansas, and we loved the Dodgers. And, of course, loved because of Jackie Robinson and later Roy Campanella, Junior Gilliam, Don Newcomb, Roy Black, I think his name was Black.
Roy
but
Campanella.
We didn't care that much for American League Baseball, and I think maybe Larry Doby, as far as we were concerned, we knew he was black. Well, he got lost in the shuffle because he was a Cleveland Indian. But I do agree with you. He came up in the same period and probably suffered the same indignities that Jackie Robinson suffered, but Jackie Robinson was just Jackie Robinson. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yes, very much so. I mean, the pioneer, the first that comes in, is always going to get that kind of attention. And the Dodgers, in lots of ways, do become America's team, certainly for black Americans across the country, and had that step up on it. One of the ironies, of course, though, of that is that the ownership, and Branch Rickey was wonderful in so many ways, but Bill Veeck, too, was wonderful in terms of bringing Satchel up after Larry, and in fact paying more fairly to the Negro League owners for the players that were brought up than the more penurious Branch Rickey did. But I think you're right, that first player and the capture of the imagination of put them a step up on Larry in the American League.
Yes, thank you, sir.
Well, I have to wrap things up here. I just wanted to have a chance for Dr. Hogan to throw in any other 2 cents worth about what do you think needs to be done in the future for preservation of Negro League history.
Well, certainly the story is now out in ways that it wasn't 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And when I started 20 some odd years ago, but it is such a wonderful story, and we need to continue to tell that story in as many ways as possible, through the way that Mr. Westfield does, through the exhibits that are there, through the video documentaries. We have one, and certainly continue to honor and recognize the wonderful legacy that comes to us from the gentlemen of the Negro Leagues.
Dr. Lawrence Hogan, Senior Professor of History at Union County College of New Jersey. He's the lead author, the main author of the book, Shades of Glory, The Negro Leagues and the Story of African American Baseball. It's published by the National Geographic Society. You can check it out at nationalgeographic.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it, Larry.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk with you and a delight to talk with Mr. Westfield.
And our other guest was Ernie Westfield, pitched 7 seasons for the Birmingham Black Barons. He makes his home in Urbana, participates in vocational baseball activities, and we can see you at them quite frequently.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Ernie.